Thank you for listening to CJSF. That's it. Thanks.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
Iran vows to avenge the deaths of several officials killed by an Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria.
Explosions lit up Israel's night sky as interceptors took down dozens upon dozens of Iranian-launched drones.
Concerns this morning after Israel's apparent attack on Iranian soil.
These people wandering around Toronto's Pearson Airport got a tip on an incoming flight. Someone from Iran. Reportedly someone close to the murderous regime. Someone may be hoping to slip in unnoticed.
Why are you coming here? You are working for the Iranian regime.
The leader of the opposition has been vocal about getting tough with the Islamic Republic.
To think that we might have terrorist-linked Iranian regime thugs operating with impunity, spending stolen money, and intimidating Canadian Jews and Iranians is appalling.
Canadian media coverage of the war in the Middle East has, unsurprisingly, focused on the impact on diaspora communities here in Canada. This includes Canada Land's own coverage. We have heard about Jewish Canadians. We have heard about Palestinian Canadians. We have heard in general terms about the many Muslim communities across Canada and how this is all affecting them. But there's one diaspora community that is increasingly at the center of this conflict who we have heard very little about, and that is the Iranian community. Canada is home to the second largest Iranian diaspora in the world. There are 400,000, so what are they going through? On the one hand, the answer to that question is probably that they're going through the same thing that the rest of us are going through. Diaspora communities have a few things in common. We're feeling this in multiple ways. For those of us who have family and friends who live in countries that are under attack, we're just afraid for people's safety and well-being. Meanwhile, diaspora communities in Canada are also concerned about ourselves, how our families and neighbors and ourselves right here in Canada are being increasingly targeted in an increasingly angry, vitriolic conflict. There is also, for all of these communities, internal divisions here in Canada. The arguments and fighting and dinner table conversations have been hard. And then, of course, all of these communities are impacted in the way that everybody is impacted, watching on as the death count overseas grows. So how is this conflict affecting Iranian Canadians? In all of those ways, it will come as no surprise. But there are some specifics about this community that have gone unexamined. We have heard that all of this stems from a shadow war that has been going on for years between Israel and Iran. We have heard, and it has been documented, that Iran has been funding Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen. Now that shadow war has been dragged out into the daylight, and there are open hostilities between Israel and Iran. Perhaps they are over, perhaps they are not. All of this just increases the pressure on this community that we have not really heard that much about, which is not to say that they have not been active. Iranian Canadians have been incredibly visible and active and outspoken during this conflict. There has been a presence of Iranian Canadians at pro-Israel rallies. There have been Iranian Canadian speakers speaking in support of Israel at many of these rallies, and some of the leading voices on the pro-Palestinian side have been the voices of Iranian Canadians. Now listen, I do not know much about the Persian diaspora, but what I do know is that this community is complex, and no one person can represent an entire community. None of the people that I'm going to speak to today claim to represent the community. But we have found three people among the Persian diaspora here in Canada. Three people who have all been very vocal about the conflict in the Middle East and three people with very different points of view about the conflict in the Middle East, and a lot of knowledge about what Iranian Canadians are going through. In a minute, they're going to sit down with me to try to take me through these dynamics and to get through some of the issues that they have with each other. Samira Mohyeddin is a journalist and radio host. She's worked as a producer at CBC's The Current, and she hosted the CBC food and culture show Unforked. Kaveh Shirouz is a lawyer, human rights activist, and senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute. Earlier this year, he launched a campaign to run for federal office. He wanted to be the conservative candidate for Richmond Hill, but he withdrew from that race, claiming foreign interference into his campaign from the Islamic regime of Iran. Finally, Amir Atran is a professor in both the Faculty of Law and the School of Epidemiology, Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of Ottawa. He writes about public health and global development issues. Wait for it.
I'm Amir Atran. I'm a law professor at the University of Ottawa.
My name is Samira Mohyeddin. I'm a journalist based in Toronto.
And I'm Kaveh Shirouz. I'm a lawyer and a human rights activist.
Canadian coverage of the conflict has focused on our diaspora community. Specifically, we've heard about the Canadian Jewish community and how they're experiencing things, the Canadian Palestinian community, and there's been coverage generally of Muslim communities. We have not heard much about what is happening with the Canadian-Iranian community specifically. Recognizing that none of you can speak for an entire community and none of you would do so, but we've asked you to join us today because each of you does have a different perspective, an informed perspective on how this is impacting Iranian Canadians. And I'm wondering if you could each kind of take a whack at orienting me a little bit. Like, what is the atmosphere like, if it can be described succinctly?
I think it depends. I think the conversations around dinner tables are different than the conversations that are being had in boardrooms and newsrooms, et cetera. I mean, I'm speaking mainly for myself, but the Iranian diaspora is very much impacted by this because you can't almost talk about what's going on in Israel-Palestine without discussing Iran, whether it's their involvement in this or how the government in Iran takes up Palestine and wears it as a sort of badge of honor, as a sort of, we're the only ones who support the Palestinians. And you're also seeing people in the diaspora who, like, the hashtag Iranians stand with Israel was trending on Twitter. I've gone to protests in Toronto where you see the three same Iranians in diaspora, you know, coming in the middle, basically acting like agent provocateurs, inciting people to react to them. They're wearing Israeli flags, also wearing the, you know, lion and sun flag. And if you go back to the sort of dining tables and in people's kitchens, I know of major conflicts going on within families, and particularly among sort of younger Iranians versus their parents' generation, who right now, because you have a government that sort of takes on Palestine the way it does, there is a large group of people who, whatever the Iranian government says, they will do the total opposite. So even if, let's say, the Iranian government says it's sunny out, and it is sunny, people will say, no, it isn't, it's raining. Iranians have been lied to for so long by this regime that they can't even believe something when it is true, right? So I think that, I mean, there's a lot of tension in the community, and I don't think it's going to be going away anytime soon.
Kaveh?
Well, first of all, I think there's two separate issues at play. One is the prospect of war with Iran. So that's one debate. And I mean, these two debates are related, but one debate is about the prospect of Israeli-American war with Iran. And then the second discussion is around how people feel about the Israel-Palestine conflict. On the Israel-Palestine conflict, you know, I agree with Samira. I think there is a fair degree of tension. What's interesting to me is that, you know, this is not the first time Israel has had conflicts with the Palestinians. And I think about what the reaction in my own circles, my own community has been, you know, in the past decade or last 15 years or so. And I would say 15 years ago, 10 years ago, there would have been much more of a knee-jerk sentiments in favor of the Palestinians. I'm seeing that less now among, you know, my circle and what I see online. Obviously, a lot of this is self-selection and, you know, selection bias and so on. But I think a lot of Iranians in the diaspora recognize that we and the Israelis have a common enemy in Hamas. They see in Hamas something that reminds them a lot of the regime that they escaped. They agree that with the Israelis that you know, Hamas has to be eradicated. I have certainly, you know, just personally, my views have certainly shifted over the past decade. I think probably 10 years ago, I would have been much more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause in a way that I'm not now. I don't think I'm much outside the mainstream based on kind of what I'm seeing. I think there is much more sympathy towards the Israeli cause than there was maybe a decade ago.
Amir, what do you think about what you're hearing so far? Does this match your understanding of things?
No, it really doesn't. I think Iranians are no smarter than anyone else. Let's stipulate that at the outset. Being Iranian is not some sort of intellectual superpower. And what that means is Iranians can get played the same way as anyone else. And they are being played in this conflict because they do enact these knee-jerk positions that you've just heard about. What Iranians are overlooking very much is that Iran, in a sense, needs conflict with Israel as much as Israel needs conflict with Iran right now. The Iranian regime is very unpopular. So is Netanyahu's regime. The pair of them are jackasses. Let's just be clear, right? Who don't have popular support, who are, by any ruse available to them, trying to maintain power. And to the extent that they can stoke tensions with one another, those regimes gain a sense of necessity or inevitability. And we've seen that in how Israelis have rallied a little bit to Netanyahu since the belligerent exchanges a couple weeks ago. And there's been some of that in Iran as well. These are two forces, and the regimes need each other in a state of conflict in order to rally their people and gain what little legitimacy they can obtain.
I just want to pick up on something Amir said that I think is important to note when he said that Iranians are being played. Iranians, in a way, are being played because when Netanyahu sits and says, I will help you get your freedom to Iranians, it's really absurd. You know, he does have a captive audience in Iran. I look at the commentary under things that are put out by Iranian diaspora channels. The commentary under those videos coming out of Iran is very pro-Israeli. But again, those are people in that silo. So it's like, I think, sweeping judgments. One of the things that I think is really important to note is, again, the understanding that as a kid in Iran, you're taught since primary school to say, death to Israel, death to America. That's something that you're just brought up with, right? Two things happen to you. Either you go home and your parents tell you, you know, those things are just things you're taught, you're not supposed to do that, or you really take that on. And then what we're seeing in Iran is a real backlash towards this, right? We're seeing younger kids, especially Gen Z, not stepping on the Israeli flag as they enter into school, not stepping on the American flag as they enter into their schools. Even though we may see what Israel's nefarious policies in the subjugation of Palestinians is, there are people who will go against that just to go against the regime.
My understanding of what I'm being told is that in trying to understand Iranian Canadians, those of them who support Israel and who are showing up at these protests, what you are suggesting is that this is not so much to do with these people of their own volition, of their own interests, and of their own opinions saying, you know what, I support Israel, but in fact they are coming from either a country or a culture that has rammed hatred of Israel down their throats, and in rejecting the regime, that is why they embrace Israel. And furthermore, you're suggesting that they are being played, as Amir put it, manipulated, Samira, by an obsession from the IDF and from Israel, who are targeting the Iranian diaspora and trying to turn their hearts and minds against the regime for their own cynical benefit. Now, I'm generally inclined to accept in good faith that when somebody shows up in a protest and says that they believe in something, they believe in it. Kaveh, what do you make of this description of why we are seeing the presence of Iranian Canadians at these protests?
There's three of them, by the way. Let's just make that very clear. I can name all three of them.
I'm not talking about any individual person. I mean, there are particular people that have extremist views that show up at these rallies that I think maybe the people Samira is alluding to. I don't want to talk about individuals. What I'll say, though, is that I disagree with the characterization of Iranians as being played. I think, frankly, it's a little bit of a condescending view. Certainly, you know, Israel, just like many other countries, tries to get its message out to various audiences. You can call that propaganda. That's why I think every government engages in it. But I think Iranians have come over the past 40 years to kind of better understand what their own interests are. And I think what you're beginning to see is them actually rejecting, I mean, talk about being played is exactly the kind of stuff that Samira was describing. You know, from the cradle, you're taught, you know, death to Israel, death to America. You've got a captive audience in Iran at the schools, you know, through media, you're constantly taught this. And Iranians, a lot of them, especially in the diaspora, are waking up and saying, no, we reject this. I refuse to categorize that as being played. I view that as actually recognizing who your oppressor is. They recognize that the Islamic Republic and by extension Hamas and groups like that are their oppressors. And they're recognizing that they have a common cause in many ways with the Israelis.
What it seems like the disagreement, and I'm getting a sense maybe of what some dinner table disagreements have been like, is not so much pro-regime, anti-regime. It's what is the best form of resistance to the regime.
Can I just jump in with something?
Yeah.
You say that no one's pro-regime. And by and large, I am pro-regime. But what I will say is that this attitude of the Iranian regime is just like the Israeli government. To me, that is tantamount to supporting the Iranian regime. That moral equivalent, to me, really downplays the horrendous nature of Iran's regime. So, you know, when I observe the debate, when I see somebody making the argument that Amir made, I see that as tantamount to actually support for Iran's regime.
Hang on.
I think that's a leap because you're talking to people who I think have been forthright and outspoken in their opposition to the regime, right? So it doesn't seem like they're shrugging off the... I understand that you object to the moral equivalency that you've established.
Absolutely,
that.
But I mean, I think that...
But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're excusing. I mean, if anything, they're explicitly saying is just the opposite.
There's a great deal of whitewashing involved in making that claim.
I got to have a word here because Kaveh totally misrepresented what I said. Kaveh, open your ears, open them good. I never said I support the Iranian regime.
You don't need
regime.
To say that you support them. You just need to downplay the horrors of living under that regime.
And I didn't minimize that. This conversation will go in a different direction if you start putting words in my mouth. Let's not go there. What I am making clear to everybody, including particularly yourself, is that there is a certain objective equivalence, speaking as a law professor, between Iran and Israel. They both engage in frequent violations of the laws of war. They both have poor regard for human rights. These are objective facts.
These are not objective facts. I'm sorry, they're simply not objective facts. They're simply not.
They're not.
I'm sorry, they're simply...
They?
I'm
how
sorry.
Are they not?
The behavior of Iran's regime.
You're a fool. I'm going to put it as bluntly as...
I owe all of you a civil forum here. And Amir, if you're going to speak as a law professor, I think that there's a very real possibility that Israel is going to face legal consequences under the charges of war crimes. But I don't know that that's an established legal fact at this point.
There are well-researched assessments of the human rights situation in Israel and Iran both, from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the UN Office of the High Commissioner, from the European Union, from the United States. And let's be exquisitely clear, neither country comes across as a star player in human rights.
Samira, you have written in the Globe and Mail that it has become a running joke among Iranians that when the Islamic Republic government falls, half of the officials will make their way to Canada because they already have a Canadian passport. So the idea that Canada is a safe haven for members of the regime is a hard one to comprehend, given that our government has designated the regime a terrorist regime and a human rights violator. So we can talk about how there isn't like any kind of pocket of overt support for the regime, and yet you're telling me that you could like bump into a minister of the Islamic regime at like a restaurant or coffee shop who somehow got into Canada. Can you help us understand how that is the case?
I have a friend who is a professor at York University who 20 years ago was in a documentary, and she talked about seeing her torturer on the TTC, on the subway, and how that just sort of crippled her, like she couldn't move. So one of the things I didn't have space to write about is that this isn't a partisan issue in Canada. The Conservatives were using this as a way to sort of bash the Trudeau government, to say, look at all the people you're letting in. But this number of these officials coming in was under the Conservative government, was under Harper. And whether it was low-level officials or people who were accused of embezzling. And so, you know, the designation that Canada gave only happened after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, was killed.
She was arrested and killed by Iran back in September 2022.
Mahsa Amini was a 22-year-old girl who was visiting the capital, Tehran. And on September 13th, she was confronted by the so-called morality police for being allegedly dressed inappropriately. So she was taken to a police station for what the authorities called so-called re-education of why the hijab is mandatory in Iran. The authorities said that she had suffered a heart attack and died. Her family are saying a very different story, that she had suffered abuse at the hands of the police when she was in their custody.
They didn't do it when Zahra Kazemi was murdered and tortured in Iran, a Canadian citizen who was arrested in 2003. So more than 20 years ago, she was tortured, brutally raped and murdered by the Iranian regime, who denied doing that to her, you know, very much in the same way they denied killing Mahsa Amini. They said that she fell down, bumped her head. And it wasn't until years later that a doctor who actually admitted her into that hospital said there was bruising all over her body and signs of a brutal rape, torture, murder. And all Canada did in that respect was recall their ambassador. They didn't shut down the embassy. It wasn't until a decade later that you saw the Iranian embassy in Ottawa shut down. Some of the Iranians that I've spoken to in diaspora really lament the fact that the Canadian government really started going against Iran really hard after October 7th. And it was always this sort of, you know, we've been telling you this for so long. You didn't give a shit when they were killing Iranian Canadians, but now you care when Israelis are being massacred. A lot of Iranians are like, we tried to warn you, but you didn't listen.
So this was just a lack of...
I think it's naivete about how easy it is to actually, and you know, you had right now, one of the people that I wrote about in that Globe and Mail piece was a former interior deputy minister whose job it was basically to deny the killing of more than 1,500 protesters on the streets of Iran in November 2019. It was his job to do that. He made his way here. He was living here.
Kaveh, you have alleged that there is foreign interference in Canadian politics. When we talk about foreign interference in Canadian politics, the names that come up are China and India. I don't hear so much about Iran, but you withdrew your candidacy alleging that there was foreign interference. So this is just helping informationally to orient listeners here on like what is going on within this community. We don't have a lot of support for the regime, but apparently we have interference from the regime in our domestic politics.
Interference takes many forms. You know, I had a personal encounter with that, and I'm going to be talking about it in the second phase of the foreign interference inquiry. I'm going to be giving testimony there. So the interference takes many forms. Part of it is, as Samira was describing, you know, folks with ties to Iran's regime, security officials, you know, people in the banking sector, whatever, people that have embezzled large amounts of money, people that have ties to the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, finding their way to Canada, living here in, you know, some of the most expensive mansions in Toronto and Vancouver and elsewhere. And, you know, people that go out and participate in Canadian politics or participate in protests focused on Iran or activism focused on Iran, they're deeply afraid that, you know, they're going to be photographed or, you know, there's going to be a record of their activism that's going to be passed back to the authorities in Iran and they'll be targeted. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is the online manipulation of the discourse that happens. And I think that's actually what I encountered more in my own experience, my own candidacy.
So what happened to you?
I declared that I was going to be seeking the nomination of the Conservative Party in the riding of Richmond Hill, a riding that actually has a significant Iranian-Canadian population, even before I announced it. There was a concentrated effort to attack me, to defame me, to lie about me, to spread disinformation. And it's not so much, you know, the little bits of disinformation being spread about me. It's the amplification of those lies hundreds of thousands, if not millions of times online that really sort of threw a wrench in the works.
How do you know it was foreign interference?
How do I know? I mean, with a lot of these things, it's almost impossible to prove except when you observe the behavior online. And I've been observing the online behavior of the Iranian regime's so-called cyber army, their bots, for many years. And a lot of what happened appeared to me and many others who observed it as very inorganic. There is no reason why somebody like me, for example, running in a little election in a little 905 riding, their name needs to trend on Twitter, for example, twice in 2 weeks, except through bot manipulation. I was observing some of these accounts that were retweeting and spreading this disinformation.
So in the short time that we've been talking and trying to understand just what are the different opinions, what are the rifts, we've heard that there's an accusation that hearts and minds are being manipulated by the Israeli government, and another accusation that hearts and minds of Canadians are being manipulated by the Iranian regime. There seems to be a great deal of suspicion and fear that things are not what they seem. Is this something that is part of the culture that we're trying to describe here? Is there an atmosphere? And Amira, let me ask you your thoughts on this, of paranoia, maybe even warranted paranoia. Are people afraid of each other?
I think, Jesse, what you've just described, I view as banal. Of course there is Iranian interference with the diaspora here. Of course there is Israeli interference with our government. I mean, my goodness, Israel has flown how many of our MPs to visit Israel? Those are banalities. Those are just the way it is. Does it result in people like Kaveh making different assessments about running for office or not? Well, he says it does, and I believe him. But this is just in the nature of being a multicultural country, as we wonderfully are in Canada, that certain pressures from the quote-unquote old country bear upon us. And I don't think it is realistic to expect that Canada can erect a moat around itself to remain unaffected by Iranian or Israeli or Chinese or Indian or what have you influence, nor do I expect it to be the case that some people will find it very upsetting, while most of us actually just accept it as a fact of life.
Samira, that's different than what you were saying. You know, to imagine that there's just a certain amount of static that we should just accept and that that's true of any population. And Amira, that does remind me of like some of the shrugging off we heard about the idea of Chinese interference. Well, this is just global politics and countries are going to propagandize and it's nothing to get too concerned about. And then we find out that actually there was transfers of money and there were voters were being bussed in. It actually seems like there was quite a bit more to it.
That's a fair point. And I'm not saying this to excuse illegality, violations of election laws and such. No, I'm not saying it to excuse that, but it is a fact of being in a multicultural society that diaspora politics get dragged here from the old country.
And I've read elsewhere about people being afraid of informants or afraid of consequences for their family back in Iran. That is different than the normal status of diaspora politics or old world politics come in. That seems to be a reason to be concerned, cautious, fearful.
It is for people who are actively organizing protests against the regime. And specifically, I'm going to point out the family members of the PS752, the downing of the Ukrainian Airlines plane. Those family members, particularly people who have been organizing and trying to get justice for their family members, they are directly threatened. They receive messages in their WhatsApps. They're followed. I mean, things are happening to them. They're not being paranoid.
Can you remind us briefly of the details of that tragedy?
So on January 8th, 2020, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps shot down a passenger plane. 176 people were on this plane. The plane was leaving Tehran. They denied shooting down the plane for 3 days. Then they fessed up after satellite imagery showed that, in fact, it was you who did it. Two missiles killing 176 people. 138 of them were on their way to Pearson International in Toronto.
Notably, for the purpose of our conversation, 85 of them were either Canadian citizens or permanent residents in Canada.
Yeah. And so those families have been threatened. But one thing I wanted to pick up on, just in terms of diaspora politics, you mentioned, Jesse, about people not trusting one another. I think it's a fact. I mean, I see it. Iranians don't trust one another. If you're meeting someone that you don't know, you suss them out. You know, where do you stand on this? Where do you stand on that? And you don't really reveal how you feel about certain things. But I think that has to do a lot with